So we're here with former President of Ireland, Mary McAleese, and the Gregorian University. You have just given an hour's lecture or conversation, should I say. It was more of a dialogue on peace building through dialogue and reconciliation. And there was one thing you said during that hour of conversation. The Good Friday Agreement actually never was a promise that fighting was over, but it was a promise that the two sides involved in what we know as the Troubles in Northern Ireland would try to work together at ending the fighting. So really the peace process in Northern Ireland, you pointed out, is never over. It's a process.
Yes, and subsequent to the Good Friday Agreement, there were many moments of awful violence. But the important thing was that in that moment of the Good Friday Agreement, people had decided to compromise enough to create a common platform that could lead to a shared future. They knew in signing the agreement, an agreement based on parity of esteem, all sides, all political ambitions accommodated. Everybody had given, everybody had compromised a little in order to create the agreement. So, and there had been a referendum on the agreement so that people had been able to tick the box and say yes. So now it was theirs and they'd a vested interest in it. And they wanted, and it was an expression of their desire for peace. But they also knew that the peace was not going to come the next day. And because you cannot turn your back on 900 years of received history and bitterness and division and an accumulation of mountains of hurt and mountains of always looking at the other with a jaundiced eye, you cannot change that. You just can't turn that ship around because you've decided right now this minute it isn't what you want anymore, the direction's the wrong direction. It's like a big, big, big ship out at sea. If it wants to change direction, it has to make a very, very, very big wide turn. It takes time. So this was a big wide turn. And everybody knew they were signing up. That's why it was always called a process. And so here we are, and the Good Friday Agreement was 1998. It has achieved extraordinary things. People who wouldn't talk to each other, even a short time ago, people who wouldn't shake hands with each other, who wouldn't be seen in each other's company, are now running Northern Ireland in a shared government. And the leadership that that gives cascades back down through the system, because they're now doing things together, not doing things apart, not doing things to each other or at each other, but with each other. And the image of that is constantly eating up the ground, colonising the space that was previously colonised by mutual contempt and hatred. But there's still a lot of work to do. We've seen it in recent times with the response in some quarters to the decision in Belfast to reduce the number of days in the year that the Union flag flies, the Union Jack. Now, under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, everybody agreed, including Catholic nationalists, in particular Catholic nationalists, that Northern Ireland is constitutionally part of the United Kingdom. Having done that, that means the Union Jack is the appropriate flag of Northern Ireland. But that agreement was in the context of parity of esteem for all sides. And flags and emblems are very neuralgic. So the agreement gave a way of being able to honour the commitment to accepting that the flag of Northern Ireland for the time being, until the people of Northern Ireland, if they ever decide otherwise, it is the Union Jack, but also to give people the right to create a society where everybody felt comfortable. And so I can understand why people, having changed the pattern of usage from 365 days a year to 17, why people, it gave them pause for thought. And unfortunately, tragically, I think, in many ways, those who are rioting are very much the people who probably were never brought on board with the Good Friday Agreement. They were probably always anti the Good Friday Agreement. And the people who were pro it would have expressed their opposition to the reduction in the number of days the flag is flying, but they'd have expressed it in a democratic way. They'd have registered their upset. And that's it. They also then accept the democratic process and move on. And then use the experience of that to find ways of dealing with neuralgic issues in the future in ways that do not lead to violence. Regrettably, I think the young people who are involved in this violence are a new generation who really do not know the cost of violence.
In fact, I wanted to speak to you and also ask you about the importance of historic memory. You grew up very much, and your family and your peers, immersed in the Troubles of Northern Ireland. Many of those protesting the flag decision are from a younger generation who have no historic memory of the Troubles. How important in peace building and in dialogue for peace is passing on to new generations the historic memory of what that peace has cost.
I think there is a real dilemma here, because in the past we handed on, both sides handed on that baton of historic memory in order to hand on the hatred. It was the conduit for the spores, the toxin of sectarianism, the toxin of political hatreds to be handed on, was through historic memory, as both sides gave their own children and their children's children their highly edited version of history, which also of course always cast the other in a particularly nefarious light. So we have to be careful about how we hand history on and also why we hand it on. There's a big difference between handing historic memory on, like we do, for example, of the Shoah, in order that Europe never ever again descends into that madness, that idiocy, that extraordinary evil. And similarly, I think in Northern Ireland, it's important that we hand on the memory of suffering, what kind of price was paid for the Good Friday Agreement, why the compromise, why the need for compromise, why was it so important? I think the fact, for me anyway, when I think back to all the years that I would have invested in peace building, I never ever was without the memory of my friends who died. On my desk every day and still today is a photograph of my two friends who were murdered the morning of my wedding. Two wonderful, innocent men who were killed in a sectarian murder. And they were two Catholics. The next day, the father of a Protestant friend of mine was murdered in retaliation for them. You know, what was the point? The wastefulness of it. And not just their lives wasted, their children's lives, their families, their wives, the whole ripple effect. Now, and I think it's important to remember that suffering and to remember it in a way that is generous on both sides, to understand that that suffering is not demarcated. Catholics didn't feel more pain than Protestants or vice versa. And to want an end to that is a noble thing. But there is a generation now who don't have that experience. They don't know what it was like to live with bombs and bullets and police presence and army presence on the roads, the abnormality of all that. They don't know what it was like to spend time in prison for committing offences, as many of the paramilitaries who have invested so much in the peace today have. They spent time in prison, they wasted their young lives there, and the very thing they didn't want was another generation, if you like, blooded in violence. And so I think we all have to put our heads together to see what we can do to try and calm the waters now, to make sure that these young people, whatever it is, and I think actually it has moved way beyond a flag protest, because there are manifest elements of strong sectarianism at work here. And, you know, attacking Catholic churches and that sort of thing, which is sort of stuff that we're hoping was part of the past. But we obviously have work to do now, and I would compliment the people who are doing that work. In particular, I think the people for whom it is very difficult. And I'm thinking here of the Protestant paramilitaries who've invested a lot now, who've probably travelled the longest distance in order to become Democrats and believers in political process. And they are under enormous pressure at the moment. And I think that they are key, absolutely key, because they know who these young people are. These young people sometimes look up to them and sometimes disrespect them, but they have a link to them that other people do not have. They have a line to them, a conduit of communication. And I think we are really relying on them to do the talking and to do the persuading that will get these young people off the streets and into some more meaningful way of living.
During this evening's discussion, you spoke of the great commandment of love and how that has motivated you as a young girl at 16, 17, 18, seeing your friends being sucked into this cycle of hatred. As a young woman who decided to pursue a career in law, who went on to become professor of law, not only in the north, but then came down south and became a journalist, interested and committed always to human rights, who was involved at a very early stage in the peace process, and then, of course, in your two terms as president of Ireland. What motivated you then? What still motivates you today? Because today you're still very committed.
It's the same thing. I mean, it's just that. It's the great commandment to love one another. It's the thing I love most about the story of Christ. For me, it's the core. it's what makes his historic intervention in human existence meaningful. It's what confers meaning on it. That there would have been a moment in history when God sent his son to us to tell us something that is actually a great truth, a very difficult truth, but a truth nonetheless that we had to know because we live with all sorts of fractured relationships at a personal level, on the street, in the workplace, in the community, inter-country, intergovernmental. We live with the human condition that is always threatening to fall into the chaos of fragmented, fractured, and often conflictual and violent human relationships. And we're always asking ourselves the question, how in the name of God can we move from that position to what's in our heart, which is the desire to live with, to have peace? And that's a very, 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 very difficult road to go. And here comes this person who tells us, actually, the way is very simple, but also very difficult. You have to love one another, not with this mushy, slushy love that, you know, that all the songs are about, but with this inordinate discipline of love, which is to love your enemy and to love him in such a way that you outreach generously and that you do not allow yourself to indulge in contempt or hatred or to live mired perpetually in a sense of your own victimhood, but rather that you have to be propelled out of that into a space where you seek reconciliation at whatever cost with that person from whom you are estranged, with that cohort, with that group from whom you are estranged. Why? Because the price that you pay for being in conflict is a much, much greater price than the price of lowering your pride and offering love or compromise, the compromise that very often is the discipline of love, to that person in order to create a common platform of peace or for peace. And that's been my experience. My experience in 14 years building bridges as president of Ireland and outreaching to the group, to groups of people who absolutely hated us at the very beginning, hated my husband and I, and thought that we were terrible people altogether and that we were, that we'd all sorts of, you know, subversive and awful hidden agendas, and that we were, you know, that if they came near us at all, they would be contaminated, that we were trying to turn them into Catholics or trying to turn them into Irish nationalists. And so we knew that, we knew that we had work to do to persuade them that that was not what we were about, that we simply wanted a country where people could be friends and good neighbours, because we're not going anywhere, they're not going anywhere, we're always going to be neighbours to each other. If you're going to be neighbours to each other, believe you me, it's an awful lot better if your neighbours are good and dependable neighbours who are kind to one another and look after each other than people who go toe-to-toe with each other and hate each other and teach their children to hate each other. Because that's, well, I've been there. And that's hell.